last couple of weeks, but last week we talked about manna and God's purpose and what he was doing. You know, we think about 40 years of eating manna. It's hard for us in our culture to understand because where do we go out for dinner on Sunday afternoon or whatever, Sunday night? I mean, what kind of food do we want? You know, we're pretty different, but God gave them manna for 40 years. Obviously, it sustained them. It was good to eat. He said it was like honey on a wafer. I'm sure it wasn't bad to eat, but it was purposeful and it was training. He was trying to reorient their thinking from life is about consumed in survival, consumed in food and shelter and fruit and clothing, as slaves to a different way of viewing life. I don't think the transition from their slavery to becoming God's people really looks any different than it does for us. And I really don't think it's any more extreme or any farther off. I think we, in some ways, maybe are having even a more difficult time reorienting our thoughts and our ways. It's good to see you home, Ashley. Is your back okay? Better? Need some whiskey or what? Yeah. That was recorded, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay, good. Good. It's amazing because as I was reading this week, I was reading through the Sermon on the Mount and again and how Jesus was trying to do the same thing, as far as setting the precedence of the people and how it would look very different from even what they knew then. The Israelites, the Jews at the time were, very religious by nature. I mean, the people that he taught around Jerusalem were very, for the most part, were very religious. And yet he was teaching them something that was completely distinct and out of place for them. It looked completely different. When you look at it, though, it looks very much the same as what God is trying to teach these people. So, let's read through 17. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for them to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Seems like a fairly consistent, continual thing. But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua — this is the first time we see Joshua, he becomes kind of Moses' right-hand man and certainly becomes a leader. He's the one that ended up leading the people into the promised land. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Amalek was a descendant of Esau, probably. That's what he was a descendant of Esau. "Tomorrow I will station myself on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Hur was probably his brother-in-law, probably Moses' sister's husband. So, and Aaron obviously with his brother. So Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Then Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on each side, one on one side and one on the other. Then his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek for generation to generation." There's a couple things in there that I think are important. Oftentimes it's, I think there seems to be a fairly common thread. They talk about Moses lifting his hands up, that he was praying, but I don't know quite where they get that and don't really see that in there. I'm not sure that that's, that his staff was always a symbol of the power of God. And holding his staff, taking his staff in his hand and holding his hands up was teaching the people that, yeah, they needed to go fight, much like us, you know, that they needed to go fight Amalek, but they were utterly dependent on God. It's always a balancing act that we have in our own lives, you know. Do we do it, or does God do it, or do we wait for God, or, you know, I think it's a very, very important posturing to take, and it's what God's trying to teach these people, to be utterly dependent on Him, and yet obviously He's going to call them to go fight. It's the same with us. I mean, we tend to think, well, we get impatient pretty quick. We tend to say, well, I prayed and God didn't answer me, so I'm going to go do it, or whatever might be our excuse. We don't even think to pray, I need to do it. If I don't do it, who will? And yet we need to recognize that we need, and this is what God's trying to teach them, they're utterly dependent on Him. So, in that, you know, it was pretty obvious, you know, he told them to go on the hill and raise his hands up, and when his hands got too tired and went down, it, you know, the Amalek people won and prevailed against them when he held his hands up. It was a symbol that they were utterly dependent on God's power. Yeah, they need to go fight, but they were utterly dependent on God's power. You know, Amalek is something that we should, it's the same God, again, that we serve today as we serve then. It seems unfair that he wiped out, he said, "I'll utterly wipe out this people from under heaven, the memory of these people." You know, God is patient, God is long-suffering, God always desires to draw people to himself, but there comes a point where God says enough's enough. You know, it seems like, you know, the same thing in the Canaanites. When the people spit in God's face, I mean, the Amalek people had heard, everybody had heard, you know, there's no doubt everybody had heard that this God of these Israelites had utterly destroyed the most powerful army on the face of the earth. They'd utterly destroyed the army of Egypt. It was the most powerful country known at the time. One of the more, maybe up until that time, is tremendously powerful, wealthy and powerful. And God had utterly destroyed them. And they had heard of this God, he'd utterly destroyed them, but they had no fear, no reverence, no respect. You can say, well, they weren't Jews, so then God killed them. God was unfairly choosing Jews over other people. Well, that's not the case, as we'll see shortly with Jethro and those people. But that they completely disrespected God, that they dishonored the God of the Jews, did not fear, had no fear, no reverence. They attacked the people. And I think there comes a point where because God is, he did it several times, when they went in the promised land and he said, kill all the people, you know, kill the men, kill the women, kill the children, kill their animals, you know, which is very difficult for us to understand that kind of a God. But I see it this way, not to oversimplify, but I see it this way at times. There comes a point in a culture and a civilization where people in their rebellion to God just are unwilling to honor God as God, or unwilling to acknowledge God as God. And in the process, they have children who they teach to not honor God, who have more children who they teach to not honor God. And I would contend that there comes a point in God's saying, I will wipe them off the face of the earth, where it is out of compassion and grace for future generations that would come. God says enough. You know, when there is a people who are unwilling to acknowledge me, when there are people that are, you know, they're doomed. You know, this is a God who is fair. This is a God who has made a way, I believe, for all men. And he wishes that none would perish, whether then or now. I mean, obviously, Amalek was a descendant of Esau, right? I mean, that came from a pretty tight lineage there. You know, Jacob's brother, you know, doing it. And yet, God said enough. I'm not going to continue to allow generations to be born to end up in eternal separation from me, because there's no hope for this people. These people have hardened their hearts so hard. So God kills them, going to wipe them off the face of the earth. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, remember who Jethro was? He was Moses' father-in-law. Heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife, Zipporah, after he had sent her away, and her two sons, who one was named Geshem, for he said, I have been a sojourner in the land, and the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the son of Pharaoh, from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. And he said, sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Then Moses went out to meet her father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare, and they went into the tent. You know, that's always a tough one. We don't really know. There isn't any mention of when Moses left to go back to Egypt to be used for God to deliver. He'd been married for probably about 40 years, and had two sons. You know, we tend to think of his sons. Remember the incident out there where God was going to strike him dead? The angel of death came, whether to the son or to Moses, and said, I'm going to strike you dead. And Moses knew what he'd done, and he circumcised, or his wife circumcised her son, right? Who might have been 40 years old or something. You know, probably was not a little baby, you know, at the time doing this. After that, we don't see her in Moses' life and don't hear of her in Moses' life anymore. She went back, seemed to go back at some point to her father, Jethro, and remain there. And then we see this incident where she comes out in the desert where they are at the Mount of God at Horeb. Horeb actually is a name in scripture that coincides with Sinai. Use it for Sinai. So they were potentially within sight of Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is often used as a particular hill, particular mountain, But Horeb is those mountains where Mount Sinai is. So they were about at the end of their first part of their journey, you know, where they were going to spend a year or so at Mount Sinai. And so they were in that proximity, and here comes Jethro, because he'd heard about this. So this is the region where Moses had been shepherding, where he had spent 40 years in the desert learning about God. So this is probably close to home for Jethro and the family. And he came and greeted Moses. Obviously, they had a good relationship. This, I would contend, this is a very sweet testament to. It looks like this is a time when Jethro came into a relationship with the true and living God. He'd heard of this God, but Jethro was a priest of Midian, remember? And they worshipped other gods. And, you know, sometimes there's been speculation that when Moses went there, that he learned about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he learned about the true and living God, that he learned about the I Am God from Jethro. But Jethro worshipped other gods. And he seems at this point to have, it looks to me like a conversion, where he honored God for who God truly is. So they went in the tent, and Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. So that was sweet, and seeing what God had done. What was God's purpose? Remember, he said that it was to show the people of Israel who he was, who his name was, that I am who I am. It was to show the Egyptians who it was, and to show all the people, all the nations, who he was, right? And here's this process of showing all the nations. God's purpose in setting up the nation Israel was not just to say exclusive, okay, these are my people and the rest of you are out of luck. That was never God's purpose. God's purpose was to set these people up as a light, to set these people up to reflect who he was, to show the world who he was, to a people to work directly through. And in that process, he chose a pretty hard, stiff-necked people, to do that, because that would show his glory. And in throughout history, he, up until the time of Jesus, I think, you know, particularly, that he worked through that nation to show the rest of the nations, the rest of the world, to be a light on the hill. Jesus talks about the same thing in the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to read that when he was saying, okay, I want to set you up as my people to be a light to the whole world. And God's purpose in bringing them out wasn't just to bring the people, you know, because, I mean, it was sad. You would think God knew on some level that they would be rebellious. I mean, they ended up 40 years in the wilderness. You know, most all the generation of the people that he brought out, except for Joshua and his family, Caleb and his families, and the younger generation of people there, they all died in the wilderness without ever entering the promised land. You know, that had to be heartbreaking to God, you know, bringing him out, showing him who he was, but they never got past it, never got over themselves, and never learned to trust him. And as a result, they never did know him. But he brought them out to use them to show the other nations that, you know, we could have Exodus to show us. We could have this, I mean, it's an amazing story that God was orchestrating to draw us. I mean, who are we, you know, that God would draw us? We're I don't believe I have any Jewish blood in me, and yet I am a son of the King. And with all the promises and all the covenants that God made to them, now are mine, you know, and now are ours as believers, as Christians, as followers of Jesus. So obviously this was beginning to work, and I'm convinced it's worked throughout history where people have looked and seen the God of the Hebrews and believed in him throughout the world. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. And now when Moses' father-in-law saw that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge and all the people stand about you from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws." And Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you are doing is not good." And which seems to be a legitimate reproof. "You will surely wear out both yourself, you and yourself, and the people with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. Now, you be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God. Then teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the ways in which they are to walk and work that they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all your people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. And you shall place these over the leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear that burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you," I mean, that to me is a very sweet, reference. You know, it's not just Jethro going, "I'm telling you to do this." He's saying, "And God, you know, make sure you, this is what God tells you to do." But certainly seems to me like this is what God's saying. He says, "And God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people will go to their place in peace." So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he said. And Moses chose able men out of Israel and made them heads over the people, leaders of thousands and hundreds, of fifties and of tens. And they judged the people at all times, the difficult disputes they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father farewell, and he went his way into his own land. We're just about, you know, in chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments. So we're about to be at Sinai, and this is where God is trying to set apart a people for himself. And, you know, it kind of is a lead up into, the Ten Commandments, because obviously that's a pretty big deal. And we say, "Well, but we're not under the law, so it's not pertinent anymore. It doesn't matter anymore." And I say that's a very misunderstood and wrong way of thinking, because that's not what Jesus said. And are we under grace? Yeah, we're under grace. You know, are we saved by the law? Well, we're not saved by the law. But Jesus was pretty clear of his view on the law, and God was pretty clear. There's a couple passages that I want to read. We're going to spend a lot of time reading today, so you've got to have your listening ears on. Okay? In Deuteronomy chapter 8, this is a chapter that, this is right before the people are going to go into the promised land. Obviously, this is down the road a little bit, about 40 years later. And the people are about ready to go into the land. But Moses is charging these people and giving explanation for what this has been all about, what God's purpose. Because again, it's important for us, not just as a history lesson. It's important to us because this is the same way God draws us now. This really hasn't changed, and it doesn't really look any different. We don't have to go hang out in Sinai, but, you know, it doesn't look a lot different. And the commandments that I'm commanding you today, this is Moses giving the charge. The commandments I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give your forefathers. And, you know, I was struggling which sequence to look at this in because, again, the Sermon on the Mount, we read some of that last week, you know, a passage about God's reorienting what really matters, you know, the whole issue of manna, the whole issue of dependency on God, the whole issue of changing our perspective from it's about the material things of this world to man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Now that's, we've heard that, and that seems like one of those hyper-spiritual things, you know. You know, that's, doesn't fill my belly, you know. I mean, doesn't, you know, how does that work? You know, that just seems kind of metaphorical on doing it. But it's not. God, Jesus was trying to reorient the people. Moses was trying to reorient people. The bottom line is God is trying to reorient his people that it isn't about the things of this world. This is a very short temporal time. I know that I have a very different perspective on the snow. You know, whenever the snow is leaving the spring, I'm kind of like, well, no, slow down, you know, because before we know it, it's gone. And it's going to be too stinking hot as far as I'm concerned, pretty quick, okay? I mean, it happens so quick. I know sometimes this life seems to drag out and it seems like it takes forever and it seems like we're in the middle of something and it won't cease or won't go away or won't get better on doing it. But this is a whisper, this time on earth. And God says, if we spend our time consumed in the temporal things of this world, we're going to miss out on eternity. And eternity is what matters. And it is a real practical everyday distinction in the way we're supposed to think. And I don't know how to tell. I mean, I heard that all my life, you know. Jesus said, I'm the bread of life, you know. I mean, he's made statements all the time. Unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you're going, you know, it was kind of difficult at times, okay? You know, he relentlessly said he was the bread of life. That's a very real deal. Is that where we find our sustenance? Is that really what works? Let's read what Jesus said, and then we'll come back and finish on what Moses is saying to these people, because they're the same. In Matthew chapter 5, we read a little bit out of Matthew chapter 6 last week. Matthew chapter 5. So this is Jesus trying to reorient the people that he's changing. The covenant is changing. It's a new covenant. It's turning to no longer the blood of sheep, no longer the sacrifices, the burnt offerings that Moses is going to command them to do pretty quick on doing it, which were representative looking forward to Jesus, right? It was never the blood of bulls and goats that saved men. It was always faith. It was always obedience to God out of faith that brought salvation. It was never the blood of bulls and goats or the works that they did any more than it is now. But Jesus was reorienting them because they'd gotten lost in this. I mean, remember, they were the ones that killed Jesus, you know, in that time and place. Very religious. You know, I don't know how many. You know, they said there might have been close to 1 million people or something in Jerusalem and the area around there when they came for the Passover from all over the world. I mean, it was crazy. You know, there was people that came, new temple, they were fervent, they were excited. you know. And it was a bloodbath, you know. I mean, pretty unbelievable. You know, the temple was up on the mount, and the brook Kidron was below, and they slaughtered so many sheep in the process that the brook would run red at times doing it on it. I mean, it was, you know, and so it was definitely a traumatic, impactful time in their life, but they weren't oriented right. They didn't see Jesus for who he was. They didn't know what this new way of being, this new covenant would look like. And this is Jesus doing the same thing to the people he's called, to his disciples, as God was doing to the people drawing him out of Egypt, saying life needs to look different. I'm calling you to be my people, to represent me to this world. And your lives should look different. In verse 5, chapter 5, he says, "And when he saw the multitudes, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. And opening his mouth, he began to teach them, saying, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God.'" This is the things he's trying to when he's bringing these people out of Egypt, he's trying to reorient the same thing. You know, you look at him and go, blessed are those who mourn, you know, blessed are the humble, blessed are the meek. And he's teaching them that the same things that Jesus is teaching them here. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is what he's showing them too. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. And you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. We want to be careful though. This obviously he's not saying, I want you to do your good works so that all men see them, right? Because if we go over to chapter 6, verse 1, he says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them, right? Otherwise you have no reward with your Father in heaven. What he's saying is that we should live our lives in such a way that is pleasing to God, and that will look very distinct from the world. It's something that I am I would say very challenged by in the last couple months. You know, I'm not sure that my life looks as God would want it to look. I mean, he wants us to be a city on a hill. He wants us to be a light. You know, he wants us to be different. It has nothing to do with self-righteousness. It has nothing to do with pride. It has nothing to do with a spirit of religion. But it does have to do with purity and holiness and a people called set apart that God calls us to. And that is going to look different in this world. And I am sorry to you and sorry to God that sometimes I've looked too much like this world in doing that. And that, you know, we've lost sight of there's a rebellion in my generation against people who dress in suits and go to church and set themselves apart and look very different and look very religious and for half a day a week, and the rest of the week they don't look a lot different, and they're hypocritical and they're unloving and they're not controlled by the Spirit of God and not led by the Spirit of God. And there was a rebellion that says, well, that suit and coat and didn't make the man. Didn't make the man a righteous man, which is true. But we are in, you know, cleaning your clothes up doesn't necessarily have anything to do with cleaning your heart up, you know. And, you know, it was always, and I think somewhat rightfully, I think there's a respect when you come together, no different than if you went to dinner at somebody's house or whatever, you know, do you take a shower before you go and maybe put some clean clothes on, or you wear your work clothes and stink when you go over there, you know, that's not very respectful, right? So typically when you come together, with people that you care about, you tend to, you know, look more presentable on doing it. And there is validity there. But we rebelled, and I think rightfully so, against a outward appearance, without the inward heart that seemed like hypocrisy. Jesus is doing the exact same thing. He's saying the exact same thing to the relentlessly calls them hypocrites. I mean, the people that he was hardest against, the people that made him angry, the people that revealed the anger of God and Jesus at times, the people that he made a cat of nine tails, you know, a whip, and went into this marketplace that was selling animals as sacrifice, you know. So this is a pretty religious place, you know, doing it. And he went in there and drove them out, flipped their tables over and drove them out with a whip. He wasn't asking nicely, okay, if they would stop doing this, okay. He was definitely violently angry, okay. Rightfully so, righteously so, that he did this. Who are these people? These are the people that were most devout in their pursuit of God, supposedly, on the outside. So devoutness obviously doesn't buy it. You know, the amount of energy put towards, I mean, that most of the people in Israel at the time, and certainly at the feasts and whatnot, but the people were put us to shame with their devoutness. I mean, they were very, their lives were about keeping the law, right? In fact, they were so out of control with the law that, you know, we'll, in finishing up Exodus, we'll stumble and bumble and come up with a whole bunch of things and laws that are put out there doing it. And there's a bunch more in Leviticus, okay? A bunch more in Deuteronomy doing it, okay? There was a bunch there already. But they had to come up with 1,000 more in the Mishnah to make sure they kept the ones that are in the Bible. You know, they were so careful to make sure they, you know, so they had to come up with laws to make sure they were careful to keep the laws doing it. They were so diligent and devout about doing the law. And yet he said, you're hypocrites. You're whitewashed tombs. It is not about keeping the law. But the truth is, here's what Jesus says, okay? Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until it's all accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments, remember this is Jesus, not me, a religious teacher, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness, this is speaking to us, not just them, not just the Jews at the, you know, oftentimes I think, man, I'm kind of glad I wasn't born in those days. I mean, they had a lot of laws. And the whole sacrificial law stuff was ugly and nasty and tough and a lot of blood and a lot of kill. Not that sometimes blood, whatever. But he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you, unless your righteousness, our righteousness, surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not even enter the kingdom of heaven. if you know much about the history of the scribes and Pharisees, I mean, these guys were legitimate religious people. I mean, the Pharisees, most of the top Pharisees had the first five books of the Old Testament memorized. And they were devout in keeping it. I mean, you got in big trouble if you didn't keep the Sabbath. If you didn't keep these laws. I mean, they were completely spun out of control. But they were very devout in their life was centered around keeping the law. And what does he say? Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. He goes on to say, and I think that this is important. I would encourage you to read that. Continue on, because it takes the law, like you shall not murder and you know, you shall not commit adultery, and he takes those laws and he says, okay, you think this is the law, okay, you shall not murder. It goes far deeper than that. And now he says that it is no longer just an outward thing of doing. Jesus says, the reality of relationship with me means that your heart will be changed, that you will be led by the Spirit of God. And being led by the Spirit of God, it will go much deeper than just keeping the outward part of the law. So our lives, you know, I'll jump over a minute because there's another one. And I would encourage you to read the Sermon on the Mount. This is not for another day and time. This is Jesus' description of this is him doing the same thing that God was doing to the Egyptians, bringing them out of, or the Hebrews bringing them out of Egypt. He's saying, it's going to look way different. Your life's going to look way different than it did in Egypt. As my people calling you, preparing you to be my people, I've got you in the desert here to prepare you to be my people, my special people that I'm going to bring to the promised land to show my glory to the world. Not because you're so special of people, but because I want to show my glory to the world. I want to show the world who I am. Same as us. Same is what he's accomplishing here, leaving us on this earth. He doesn't leave us here on this earth. If we are born again, you know, you would think the thing would be gone. You know, let's go out of here, right? Take care of a lot of problems, right? Doing it. But he says, no, I'm going to save you, redeem you in this world to be a light to this world, to be salt in this world. You know, he says, man, if it wasn't for the people of God left in this world, it would be utterly dark. This world would be just utterly dark and wrecked doing it. And we are here not just as a moral authority, not just as a moral correction. We are here that way. God says that we are here that way. But we are here to show God's glory to the people of this world. And is that what our lives look like? Do we look like our lives are oriented, or oriented in such a way that it reflects who God is and who He is worthy to be, and how He is worthy to be praised? You know, we talked about the manna and how God was using the manna. You know, what does He say, you know, about the manna? He says that He was using it. In chapter 16 of Exodus, last week it says, then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. So life is changing to, it is not about consuming yourself and taking care of your needs anymore. It's about consuming yourselves in His righteousness. In the Lord's Prayer, which Jesus in this sermon was teaching, and he says, I want to teach you guys how to pray, because he's teaching them pretty full encompassing what life's to look like. And one of them was prayer. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, it's just a profound thing to me that we do exactly opposite of what he said to do with the Lord's Prayer. You know, he says, And when you pray, you are not to be as the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners in order to be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, and when you have shut the door, pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will repay you. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition, as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. And, I heard somebody said the other day, was quoting somebody, and I don't know where this comes from. It might have come from the internet, so I can't believe it or something. But it was, I didn't read it on the internet, but somebody was saying it. But the comment was made that, I don't know how anybody could not be saved if they recited the Lord's Prayer even, doing it. And I mean, it's a fairly insane postulate. It has nothing to do with the understanding of biblical things. The Lord's Prayer, we've done exactly what He says. We've made it sacred and holy to come together in a reverent way and say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And I am not mocking the Lord's Prayer, but that is not the purpose Jesus said. He said, do not use vain repetition. This isn't about saying many words and repeating. Should we know the Bible? Yeah. Should we have the Bible memorized? We should have the Bible memorized. Did He say you're supposed to repeat this prayer? He said, don't do that. He said, I'm giving you the content of what your life should, of what your prayer should look like. See? So He says, do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. Pray then in this way, Our Father who is in heaven, how holy is your name. Your kingdom come and your will be done on earth, just like it is in heaven, which that's kind of absolutely in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Here's Jesus teaching us how to pray to God for our needs. The same as God was teaching the Hebrew people, drawing them out of Egypt, how they should live their lives with daily bread. And He wanted to see, He said He was testing them to see what their purpose would be, if they would be obedient, if they would be submissive to Him. And Jesus is saying the same thing. He's saying, when we pray, give us our daily bread, which means our bread for the coming day, or our needful bread, what we need. Later on, He says, you cannot serve God in mammon, right? We talked about that last week. You cannot serve God in riches, as it says. Mammon is that which is beyond your need. Okay? It's not a big bank account, or it's not a trust fund, or it's not millions, it's not thousands. It's whatever is beyond your need for subsistence. That's what mammon means. Okay? It's a very foreign concept to us. Very foreign concept to us. And I would contend, because one of the things that it is such a foreign concept to us, we have a very, just as difficult of a time as the people being drawn out of Exodus in following God's instruction, Jesus' direct instruction in the New Testament. I think it's just as difficult for us to understand. And I think we struggle in the same ways. We look at them and go, every time, man, grumble and grumble, and God does a miracle, and you grumble, and God does a miracle, then you grumble again, then God does a miracle, and you grumble again. And you're going, gosh, you guys, don't you learn? Don't you see things? Haven't you got your act together? I think if you wrote a story in a book about us, it might not look different. Okay? It might, God, where are you? Why aren't you? Okay, God, and most of us just kind of run ahead. I am fully at this point in my life under the, we have the belief, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again, because it's a major issue in our culture. We tend to see financial, material blessing, we relentlessly ingrained in our being, ingrained in our cultural souls, as the blessing of God. That if we're prospering, if things are going well, we have plenty of money, and we're able to go on vacation, everything, you are some who are blessed by God. And we tend to see somebody who is living day to day as going, where's the sin in your life? You know? What's the matter with you? I mean, how come God isn't blessing you? I am at this point, and I'm, you know, obviously in process of having God's heart on things, but I would say I guarantee the vast majority of the material prosperity in this country is not from God. It is not from God, because has it led this country to be people who honor God? No. It has not. And what does God say? You cannot serve God and more than you need, than mammon, right? You can't serve two masters. I mean, he was pretty clear about it. You say, well, it's not a master. I don't do it. I just use money. Money's just a tool. Again, I'm not saying money is wrong. Okay? But what I'm saying is it's almost, in this culture, it is very difficult to step away from serving money. From serving all the things that we think we need, you know. Mortgage, you know, it's amazing postulates in this culture. You know, we say, I own my house. Well, most of us are lying, you know, to say that, you know. I mean, my house owns me, right? I mean, I don't own my house. I mean, I am chained to that house. I've got a ball and chain held to that house doing it, you know. But if I own a house, oh, you're successful. You know, I mean, it's an amazing posture. If somebody's, I'm renting a house, oh, you low life, you know, what's the matter with you? Why don't you get your act together, you know, doing it? What's the matter with you? You're renting a house. In fact, you don't have any debt. You're just paying what you need to pay month to month doing it. Kind of, that would, if you stand back and look at it a little bit, who's free? Okay. Who has a ball and chain and who's free? Who's handcuffed here on this deal and shackled? And who isn't? But in our culture, we have that completely sideways, right? What do you do? I mean, it's a tragic thing. I, you know, had some really rough times back in the, you know, 10, 12 years ago, you know, doing it when things, recession was bad and we were rough and, man, I struggled to try to keep things afloat and keep things going. Obviously, my credit score went, because I was late on payments, you know, late on my house payments, struggling to try to make everything go, and went from a really good credit score to no credit score, where they said, laughed at me if you ever did anything. So it was terrible. So what do? Get a credit card. You know? Buy something on credit and make your payments. And now look at me, man. I got a, you know, I don't know, high credit score again now. You know, in a short period of time. Oh, yeah, you're willing to, you do good in your ball and chain, you know? You're a good prisoner, you know? We want you to be here on doing it. You know, it's a mixed up mentality, that we, and I do not, it is, all of us know from a very personal standpoint that the better things are, the less we probably spend time on our knees. Right? The more things are prosperous, when do we spend time on our knees and, God, I don't know what I'm going to eat tomorrow. Right? I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. You know? I'm not saying that we should purposely, there's no honor in poverty. There's no honor in riches. Okay? That's a lie about it. Okay? And I would contend that in this culture, in a dramatic way, the absolute vast majority of prosperity in this culture has not led people towards God, but away from God. So I have a very hard time believing that's the kind of dad he is. Okay? I do not think God's a God that says, well, but I want you to be happy, so I'm going to spoil you anyway, even if it means you're a spoiled brat, you're going to hell. I just want you to be happy, so I'm going to give you stuff. That's not the kind of God he is. That's not the kind of father he is. He's a father that's willing to let his people come out of Exodus and think they're going to die of hunger or die of thirst. Right? I mean, they come out and 3 days later they're going, we'll die! You know, we're out of water, our animals are dying, they're doing, God, what are you doing? Right? And then do it again. And then do it again. And let them go through it again. Why? Because he was neglectful? Because he wasn't paying attention? Because he wasn't able? Maybe he didn't have a good map, you know, no good GPS or something, didn't know how to lead him the right way with his water and stuff. I mean, he could have easily struck that rock before they got there, right? And water flowing, right? Could have easily thrown the tree into the, you know, I don't think he even needed to throw a tree in there, right? Into the water. And it would have been good for them to drink, right? That would have been just as easy to do. Easier, in fact. You don't got to put up with the whining. You know, it's always harder to spank your kid, right? You know, it's always harder to go through the discipline process with your child on doing it. It's, but God is a loving dad. We were talking about, Gina and I were looking at kids, neighborhood kids, whatever, kids that, whose parents don't believe in spanking, you know, whose parents don't believe in discipline. You know, so how does that end up playing itself out in life? You know, they spend their life avoiding conflict. It's like a modern day school teacher almost, right? I mean, a modern day school teacher is a completely different thing. I mean, back when I was a kid, a teacher didn't have to avoid conflict, right? I mean, you need to be quiet, David. And yet, David, you're out of here. Go to the office, threatened with a spanking, you know, by the principal. Knowing full well then my dad would really beat me when I got home if I was being bad doing, you know, that was in a good way. Not beat, and beating is legit at times. But I deserved it. You know, I was bored and disruptive and, you know, in classroom. Now that, you know, you can't dare do that, you know. I mean, David, be quiet. I don't have to. You know, what are you going to do? You know, and unfortunately, so much of parenting is that, and it's absolute utter self. Now, I understand that much of this generation has not seen godly parents and doesn't know what it means and looks like to discipline in a godly way. At best, they might have seen some person who, a parent who didn't know God, hitting something in anger, right? Disciplining out of anger. And so they say, I'm not going to beat this kid out of anger. I'm not going to spank this kid because that's just out of anger. And I'm not going to do that. I understand there's a little confusion there, but truthfully, it's selfish. It's utterly selfish. I don't want to deal with this kid on doing it because I don't think there's too many harder things to do than spank your kid or listen to your kid get spanked. Right? I think it's even harder to listen to your kid get spanked in a correct way. I mean, it's like, ugh, you know, knowing the hurt and knowing doing it, it's, like, you know, it's hard to hear a kid get disciplined correctly, right? So we're selfish. We don't want to do that. We don't want to go through with that. We don't want to see it. God is not that way. God was willing to discipline his children coming out. And in our lives, he's willing to discipline. In fact, he says, if you do not look like a if your life does not look like you have a father who is willing to scourge you, then you need to check who your dad is, right? You need, because you're not a child of the true and living God, because he said he will scourge those he loves. Strong language. You don't even talk, we're not even allowed to spank. You know how much of scourging? I mean, that's a terrible word doing it. God says that he will discipline because he loves time and time again to train up. You look at it's a terrible thing to do to this kid. I mean, I am fearful of my grandkids growing up. Because your guys' generation is screwing up bad. Okay? And my generation messed up. But now you're like twice removed and like twice as bad. Right? Now all you think that the most important thing you can do is build up a kid's self-worth and self-esteem and self-value and think highly of himself and think well of himself doing it like that and never spank. You always avoid conflict. You know why you're setting that child up for in this world? I mean, it's a terrible thing. They are not the center of the universe. They'll find that out soon enough. OK, Okay? They're not the most important thing in this world, and life isn't always going to be easy. And they don't get to throw a fit when it's not. They have to learn to trust what's going on. It's God was trying to teach them continuing to do that, going through the hard times of the desert, so that they would know how to respond in this world correctly, in faith. Not in grumbling, but trusting God. Trusting that God has this. God has this in control. I don't need to grumble. I don't need to throw a fit. I mean, you guys are in process. It's not a natural thing for a little girl, right? One that you have particularly to see life is not, you know, not being fair, you know? It's an amazing response, right? And obviously you guys are in the midst of struggling and trying to deal with that. You know, this little strong-willed child that the moment things don't go exactly her way, right? Different. I mean, you guys didn't completely lose your minds parenting. I mean, your other kids aren't that bad doing it. But, no, she did. She did earlier. Yeah. Not during singing. She made a few singing. Yeah. But to watch her, she's just, you know, it's such a response of the flesh. And they're trying. And they're trying to make it happen. And they're trying. And that will need to be eradicated from her soul. That's not the way that I respond when things aren't, I'm not in control. When I am not controlling things. Just like these people. When life's out of control, when I'm not controlling things, what is to be my response? Is it to be faith? Or is it to be grumbling? And that is something that has to be beat out of us in one way or the other. That is something that has to be, I'm thirsty and we're going to die out here in the desert, man. I mean, I think they were legitimately thirsty and the animals were legitimately thirsty and they were going, this is like really important. We get some water quick, you know. This is not going to go well, you know, if we don't get some water here doing it. I mean, we didn't say that nice even, you know. They just grumbled and grumbled at God and didn't trust God. And God, as a little child, was training and training and training and training. He said, okay, you got through it. I took care of you. Now you see I took care of you? So next time, what are you going to do? Grumble? Okay. Then you get another spanking. And then next time, what are you going to do? So you finally go, let's see, I'm really thirsty and things aren't going well. God, I trust you. I trust you. I trust that you've got this. I trust that I don't need to violently try to control my world. That's, you're fast. Push. You know. Let's finish up in Deuteronomy. Let's finish up in Deuteronomy because this is Moses explaining what this process of 40 years in the wilderness looked like. And this, you know, I would hope by the power of God, by the Spirit of God, by the work of the cross, we don't turn back in 40 years and look like this, you know? We don't turn back in 40 years and not enter the promised land. We don't, you know, there is no excuse. The reason that Jesus called for a higher standard is because we have less excuse now than they did. He doesn't talk in the Old Testament about them being born again, about the Spirit of God filling the fullness of the deity coming to exist within us. And if we don't look like that, I mean, we can't even say no to a Hershey's kiss, you know, or something, whatever, you know? I mean, the fullness of the deity dwells in me. And is that what it looks like? Under the control of, under the empowerment of, responding to life around me through? Because that's what it should. And that's why Jesus said, this is what it should look like. That's why Jesus said, be perfect as I am perfect. Okay? In chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, here's Moses again. All the commandments that I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in to possess and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your forefathers. The kingdom. And I am of the, my understanding at this point is, you know, you say, is this the kingdom age? Is this the not the kingdom? We have all kinds of conflicting stupidity that goes on about it, and not quite the fights they used to. I mean, they used to kill each other over such things. We just say, I agree to disagree, whatever. But the what is the kingdom age? What is the millennial age? And some people would think that we're already in, you know, the millennium. Some people think that, you know, we will be raptured halfway through the 7 years and another before, and some not till after, and we do all kind of, this is my understanding at this point of the kingdom. If Jesus is my king and I'm under his authority, there's a bit of a kingdom going on. And if there's a bunch of us that are under the authority of a king, okay, is obviously this the promised land? No. You know, will there be eternity in heaven where God rules absolutely in my life and in the totality of people's lives that are in heaven? Yeah, that'll look different, where he is honored for who he truly is. We're still in the process of living in this world and struggling. But we can also know the fruit of the Spirit of God living in us, of love and joy and peace and patience and gentleness and kindness and meekness and self-control. Those should be the fruit of our life. In fact, Jesus is pretty clear. Judge by your fruit. You can judge by your fruit. Does your fruit look like you're under the authority of the king? Does your fruit look like you're under the authority of the God of this Bible? So, and you shall remember, he says, all the ways which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. Does God do that with us now? He does, you know. I can pretty much guarantee you God is a loving and just Father, that if we choose to be rebellious towards something God has told us, whether in our life or in our world around us, we get to come back to it one way or the other, because God is patient. God, it is imperative that we are moving in process to obedience, just like Naomi, right? It ain't going to get better because you just go, oh, well, let's just avoid this. I don't know how you would do that with her. You'd have to lock her in a soundproof room that we couldn't hear, right? But you know, how do you, the process is one that, nope, we're going to go back to it. Nope, we're going to go back to it. When you respond this way to not getting your way, we're going to go back to it. When you respond this way, till soon you learn to go, well, that's not really what I want to do. That's not going to go well. I'm going to trust that, Dad, you're paying attention. I need something. I need to get between the chairs. I mean, it was just, it's amazing to watch the little thing. You know, she's doing it and, you know, just loses her mind immediately because she can't fit between the two chairs, you know, doing it. Which is, you know, obviously needs to change the response, needs to mature in the response of going, and I don't mean to pick on her. I mean, you have those little kids that act that way, you know, doing it. So, most of them just don't have a set of pipes like Becca, you know. So we all tend to be pretty aware and hear it, you know, in the process. But, you know, you can't, just because you can't fit between two chairs, that should be a pretty simple process. You can go around, or Dad's right there, and say, Dad, can you help me get through here, or something, you know. It's a matter of process, and God will take us through this process, he says. He says, whether you will keep my commandments or not. In other words, I'm not the center of the universe. I do not have the right to demand, whether of God or whether of people around me. I do not have the right to be selfish. Humility. Humility is what God is trying to teach us in the process too. Okay? And he humbled you and lets you be hungry. What if we said that about, let's see, good parenting. Let your child be hungry. Okay? And he humbled you. Dad's a perfect dad. God's a perfect dad. Okay? And he lets you be hungry. And he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. Why? That he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. This is Old Testament even. This isn't Jesus, the yogi dude sitting on the hill or something, you know? This is Old Testament even doing it. That's Jesus. I don't mean any disrespect. They're doing it. It's just, we sometimes say Jesus said these extreme things that, you know, they're kind of hopeful or wishful thinking, but not really pertinent to our lives, right? You know? No, he didn't. But your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, of fig trees, of pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you shall not lack anything, the land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten, listen, when you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware, lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Lest, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then your heart becomes proud. And you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you through a great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions. Spiders. Never mind. Private joke. He led you through fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness, he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you would say in your heart, you may say in your heart, my power and strength of my hand made this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant with he swore to your fathers as it is this day. And it shall come about, if you ever forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today that you shall surely perish, like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you. So you shall perish because you would not listen to the voice of the Lord your God. We need to be careful to respond. We should, number one, we should not run from and at any cost avoid God's discipline in our lives. I don't know, what child ever welcomes it, you know? I mean, it's not real legit that a child does, you know? Or any of us do, right? I don't want to be spanked, right? We all think, oh, I'll just do it right. You don't need to spank me. You know? But the other the critical thing is that we, because he's, it still is about money. It's still in our culture, I think, as much as in any culture on the face of the earth, we're materialistic. And we're money oriented. And if we, I think that we'll probably have a more difficult time understanding that man does not live by bread alone than the people coming out of Egypt. And we will not learn that correctly without going hard after that. We will not learn that correctly without being willing for God to teach us in whatever way. Now, most of us don't ever want to pray the prayer, God, do whatever it takes for me to learn humility and to be content with nothing. Right? Dang, I don't want to pray that prayer, right? You know? Because, you know, go there. I'll go there. You know, it's not worth it. God, I'll learn it. I'll learn it. Just let me have my stuff. You know, I promise I'm doing that. But we should all be absolutely desiring for God to eradicate our stuff from our hearts. You know, I don't know quite what you do about a house. I mean, it's a sweet thing that you put a ball and chain on you, because now you could just step up to a bigger prison cell, right? But, I don't know how you do this in this process of, you know, in this world and the way it's set up. I mean, it's tough, you know. If you don't go into debt, you know, you don't have any credit, you know. I mean, it's such a confusing thing when you think about it, you know. You have to go into debt for people. If you just pay all your bills and, you know, don't have any debt and do it, you're a loser, right? And you can't get a credit card, you know, doing it, much less. If you have two credit cards, they're offering you five more, okay? Come on, kind of doing this and go into it deeper. It's a pretty mixed up, convoluted, and it's a system that the enemy works in very strongly to hold us in bondage to. What is it that we are purposeful about? Do we allow that slave master, just like they did? You know, you need to move out from under that mentality. The slave masters, this is what they demanded on you for generations. These weren't a godly people. They didn't come from a godly orientation. This is what they demanded of you. In some ways, this is our country pretty quickly is changing. This is what the slave master of this country demands of you. This is what God, our master, our Lord, demands of us. And how do they disalign, or how do they align? How do we can't serve both masters. How do we please God in spite of living in the middle of this world? And what does that look like? That's what God was teaching, because he wanted them to be a people that represented his glory to the nations. Just like us. Just like us. You know? I don't think that I'm a, you know, we don't get to dress multiple colored stripes on our prison suit, man, and think that we're going to stand out in this world and go, yeah, see, I'm a good little prisoner of this world and the things of this world and the money of this world. I don't think that's how God would have us stand out. I think God would have us stand out distinct from. Does that mean we don't own a house? Or that means we're, I don't know, some of us might do. I think that's the goal of everybody. Let's see, if I can just sell five houses, I'll own one, right? You know, really difficult process in the thing. I think that's probably as destructive on any kid as there is. How many times you kid move out of a house in order to try to make this goal happen? I think a home's a very important part of a family. I think a home's a core. Doesn't have to be fancy. Doesn't have to be big. I don't know how the system could or shouldn't work different, you know? It doesn't happen very often. I know that Nate has commented, you know, about Becky, several times and seeing pictures of Becky, my daughter, growing up. And Nate lived in 14 different houses by the time he graduated high school doing it. And he looks at pictures of Becky and she's this big sitting on the stool in the kitchen, and this big sitting on the stool in the kitchen, and this big sitting on the stool in the kitchen. He goes, You're in the same house your whole life?
Yeah, I grew up in the same house my whole life.
Same stool.
Same stool.
I just would encourage you, there's some good to that. There's some stability to that. There's some foundation to that. Far more than being fancy or bigger on doing it. To set up and establish a house that you can, that the kids grow up in, that they call this home. And a house doesn't make a home, but that it doesn't matter what kind of shack it is, as long as there is a home with a loving family and mom and dad there. But that's stable, and that's something that they've known on doing. I think there's validity in that. How do you accomplish that in this world of, you know, unless you sell multiple houses and gain some money, equity on each one, how do you keep going, you know, and doing? I don't know. Those are particulars in this culture that are very hard to get outside of, okay? Okay? And to obviously be led by God to not be in bondage to the things of this world, to not serve the gods of this world, because we're arrogant. Oh, I still serve God. We serve other idols. What do we put our time into, our effort into? What are we consumed by? That's what we serve. And that's the God we serve. We can arrogantly say, well, I don't have any Buddhas in my house. I just serve the true and living God, you know? Idolatry doesn't take a Buddha. Okay? So, that's what God was teaching him coming through the desert. And he seemed like, God, why are you so mean to him? Because he loved him. He wasn't mean to him. He just disciplined him. How do we view hard times? Whether it's kids sick, whether it's whatever may be going on. If somebody's life is always good, and oh no, I'm always good, I'm always happy, things are going great. Either you're a liar, or God help you, where's your daddy? You know? Because those are really the only two choices there. Because God's going to let us go through rough times. Because he loves us, and he cares about us, and wants to teach us. And how do we view that? I guarantee you, the quicker we go, if I throw a fit, maybe somebody will move the chair. But I've learned by now that it's probably a quicker and better alternative to go, Dad, can you help me through here, or walk around, rather than throwing a fit and demand my way. And that's a narrative for all of our lives. I'm doing it. And we will come back to that chair that we can't get through if we don't. Let's pray. Our problem, God, is that it's so hard to understand. I find it difficult to eat. When Jesus said he's the bread of life, and man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of your mouth. And that we should see that as the most important aspect of the sustenance of our life. That there is nothing more valid or valuable for sustaining our lives than your truth, than your word. Do we even prioritize that over the cold cereal in the morning? I mean, it's a difficult reorientation and prioritization to change that. But God, I ask that you'd please do that so we can get out of the desert. We can quit wandering in the desert. We can be born again. We can live new life, the new life that you promise. There's nothing more wondrous than walking hand in hand with you in obedience. That should be our goal and our purpose and our desire. Not the things of this world trying to put pacifiers in our mouths or bring contentment in our lives. So God, please teach us. Please continue to push us. I thank you that you are a patient, loving Father that's willing to not turn the other way, but will spank us when we need it. And continue to, even though it's, you don't enjoy it. That would be a ridiculous, terrible, tragic, demonic lie. That when you see your kids suffer in pain, you see the long goal, you see the long purpose, and you're willing to do it. But you're always saying, please trust me. And always trying to lead us to trust you. And I thank you for that. I thank you for your patience. I thank you that you stick with us when we continue to throw our fits. We continue to have focus that's wrong, when we continue to want to be strayed and led away towards other gods. Please keep calling us back, and driving us towards you with a boot in our fanny if necessary. I thank you, Jesus, for allowing us to be part of God's chosen people, set here to represent his glory to the world, to the nations, to the spiritual realm. I thank you for that privilege. Thank you for your patience with us in it. I thank you, Jesus, for giving us the satisfaction, having our sins, the penalty for our sins satisfied. The substitutionary death on our part that we could call God our Father. I thank you for giving us that privilege, God. In the name of Jesus, amen.